Hi, this is Paul. Someone just sent me this video of Aaron's podcast, Aaron Wren, and it's a terrific conversation, and it has everything to do with the kind of stuff we've been tracking in the corner, and it has everything to do with the stuff we've been talking about with respect to modernity and leadership in the West, and there's a ton in here, so let's get started.
Show, I have two special...
Let's get started once I get the settings right.
Guest today, two more than I usually do. I only usually have one guest, but today I have two, and that's Brad Littlejohn and Chris Castaldo, who are the authors of a new book called Why Do Protestants Convert? Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yep, pleasure to be here.
Before we dig in, I'll first say that Brad Littlejohn is the president of the Davitt Institute and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And Chris Castaldo is a church historian and senior pastor at New Covenant Church in Naperville, Illinois. There's a link in the show notes to buy the book, which I'm sure you'll want to do after this podcast. And please be sure to hit subscribe and hit the like button here on YouTube. When you talk about Protestants converting, what specifically are you referring to?
Yeah,
Over two guests. I'll let you go first, Chris.
This approach we take in the book is concerned with the whole person. So we look at the psychological, theological, and social reasons why someone converts.
And now, a bunch of you have trodden this path, so I'm going to jump forward a little bit because this part is, you understand.
That there were three buckets or categories of factors leading to conversion: the psychological, the theological, and the sociological. And I want to go through those and dig in a little bit on a few of the things that you talk about. I'm not going to go through all of them because we want people to buy the book, but I want to highlight a few of the big ones. The first, under psychology, was what you called the holiness deficit. What is that?
Yeah, it's a desire to encounter God, who is transcendent, something greater than our mundane experience. And so often, to Brad's point, you walk into your typical American megachurch that is Protestant, and it's a lot like the experience you have throughout the week in terms of the screens, in terms of the felt needs that are addressed, the music, pelvic thrusting praise teams, you know, that sort of thing. And
are there really pelvic thrusting praise teams? I mean, I've seen some wild praise team stuff, but somebody out there, if you can find from a real church video, not a Saturday Night Live sketch, a pelvic thrusting praise team or someone twerking in a praise group, send it to me because I'm skeptical.
And I think people get tired of that, and that they want to have an experience that approximates Isaiah in chapter 6, where they lift their eyes above the horizon and they see the holy God. When they look to Rome and there they find a measure of reverence.
Now, what's interesting about this one is it's a sensibility.
Reverence, it has a certain attraction.
And I think that's one, just to piggyback briefly, is that I think that's one that really overlaps with the Eastern Orthodox conversionitis. That's probably the strong, talking to Eastern Orthodox converts, that's the strongest factor. And in fact, after post-Vatican II liturgical revisions, I think, you know, Rome doesn't actually have that strong of a leg up in the kind of reverence of worship often. That's why many converts don't go to their local parish. They go to the Latin Mass, you know, 45 minutes away.
Right. You basically stole the comment I was about to make.
You
know,
about
probably, 9 or 10 years ago when I first visited an Eastern Orthodox church, I just hadn't been to one other than for a wedding or something of that nature. I wanted to attend one of their liturgies. I was blown away by it. And I know that's an experience a lot of people have had. There's definitely a sense of reverence from the transcendent. That candidly has not been my experience in the Catholic Church. I've been to a lot of Catholic masses, and I've never been to one where it didn't seem like the priest was mailing it in. And in fact, you hear a lot of Catholics complain about parishes that are what they call sacrament factories. I actually find the best Western liturgies are in the Episcopal Church. I mean, a lot of times these Episcopal parishes, some of them very liberal, they take their liturgy very seriously.
It's interesting. I remember one person making the observation to me that mainliners basically go to church for the liturgy, and it's the evangelicals that go to church for the preaching and the doctrines. And in other words, sort of that propositional aspect.
Another psychological factor is what you call the inner ring. What is the inner ring, and where does that term come from?
Well, this is, of course, C.S. Lewis wrote an essay by this name, and it's a theme that comes up in a lot of his works. He talks about this Screwtape Letters, and of course, the novel, That Hideous Strength, is kind of all about this pathology. And it's that desire that I think we all have in some form or other to feel like we are, I mean, you know, in junior high, it takes the form of wanting to be in the cool kids club, right? You know, that there's this recognition that the social world is hierarchical, and there are people who are in, and there are people who are out, and everybody's fighting to get in, right? And once you go to college and you find a more sophisticated version of that, you enter the business world, and you find at your workplace there may be an official org chart, but then even despite the official org chart, there could be people who have the ear of the boss, who are the real decision makers, and everybody wants to feel like they're in that inner ring. And what Lewis shows is, no matter how inner ring you get, you find something more inner that you still feel on the outside of, right? And so I think that yearning to be in the cool kids club, to be seen to be sophisticated and savvy, I think my sense when I encounter a lot of these converts from evangelicalism to Rome, particularly in the kind of DC orbit where I lived for a few years, and I work with the EPPC overlaps a lot with that. And there's definitely a sense that if you want to be politically connected in the conservative movement, then you want to be Roman Catholic, right? That's the sort of the inner ring of influence there. And I point out, that Catholicism has always sort of by design appeals to the inner ring impulse a lot more than Protestantism. Catholicism has all these layers of hierarchy built into it. It has all these monastic orders. And there's whereas Protestantism is revolted against that. Protestantism seeks to flatten out that hierarchy and put all Christians kind of on the same level. And so I think that's natural but distorted, sinful human longing to be part of the cool kids club is something that Roman Catholicism has always by design catered to, and particularly caters to given the structure of the conservative movement now in the US.
Yes. I think the very first time we ever corresponded is in your original version of this essay, where I pointed out, and I was working for a conservative think tank at the time, look, in conservatism, Catholicism is normative. If you are involved in political conservatism, it is a Catholic-dominated movement in terms of its Christian wing, at least. Evangelicals are the votes, they're the foot soldiers, but they're not the brains. They're not the proverbial deciders, as it happens. And certainly there is enormous tacit pressure to become Catholic if you have aspirations within movement conservatism. No.
He's exactly right. I never knew this. When I went to Washington, D.C. for this conference in the summer, I was just amazed at the amount of infrastructure that the Roman Catholic Church had in Washington, D.C. There was a shrine to John Paul. There were these monasteries. There was this basilica that I remember driving down the road the first time I had flown into the airport. I had rented a car. I'm driving down the road. It's like the scale of this building rivals the scale of the monuments, the national monuments on Capitol Mall. And I thought, wow. And then when I saw this, I thought, man, oh man, this is 180 degrees different from all of the drama that we continually hear from all the regular names. December 7, David French has a New York Times op-ed, Why Fundamentalists Love Trump. White evangelicals. Let's just do the search and find here. White evangelical. Let's search for Catholic now. Mentions of Roman Catholics? Zero. What's going on? Religious News Service, which is basically progressive evangelical. What should we make of evangelical influencers teaming up with filmmaker Rob Reiner? Let's search this page for Catholic. Caught one, it's not in the article at all. Catholics are a no mention. Well, what about white evangelical? No white evangelical, but evangelical, all over the place. So what's fun about something like The Rest is History, I've gotten through the destruction of the Aztecs, and now we're on to the controversy about the death of John F. Kennedy, and of course his Catholicism comes up. Why were Americans so suspicious of Roman Catholics, especially in the colonial period? Because the French and the Spanish were their enemies. And so everything was, of course, the English Civil Wars, all over Catholicism. And, you know, this sort of was in the nation until the 1960s. And I've walked through the fact that it wasn't until the Roosevelt administration that the Roosevelt administration, in the middle of the 20th century, first starts trying to include Catholic and Jews in the ruling coalition. The ruling coalition is all Protestants. But in terms of who's leading conservative political Christianity in America, it's all Catholics. And you know, nobody's out there complaining about Ross Douthat at the New York Times, who is a conservative Roman Catholic, but the Catholics are just totally under the radar, and everybody's screaming about white evangelicals. Roman Catholics, wow, I'm completely impressed by your craft. But there's a lot more in this video,
no question, and that's something I think most evangelicals really are not aware of. They see Republican candidates reaching out for their votes, maybe pandering to them a little bit. But at the end of the day, this is a Catholic project.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where, so much of that political energy for conservatism, as you note, comes from evangelicals. A lot of, enthusiastic young interns staffing these Senate offices or whatever are coming from evangelical, coming from the Bible Belt. But then they quickly realize that if they actually want to be relevant and rise through the ranks of the movement, then Catholicism was the way to go.
It used to be that in America, Protestantism was the inner ring, right? It was the WASP establishment. It was Episcopalianism. It was all the city gentlemen's clubs. And the
Now this is where Aaron Wren has been a voice in the wilderness, because it's a historical fact. And, you know, my main protest about Kristen Cobez Dumais' Jesus and John Wayne is that it completely misses the main story, which is what Aaron Wren puts his finger on here. What happened to Protestant leadership? Catholics have sort of moved in and taken leadership, but they've sort of done so quietly.
The original sense of that term, that sort of went away. Does Protestantism need to have some sort of a status hierarchy, if not an inner ring, to give people something to aspire to?
Maybe not a hierarchy. And one of the distinctions we make between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism is the way we minister. So the Catholic tradition has a magisterium by which it extends divine authority. In the Protestant tradition, we have a ministerium. The word is at the leading edge. And I think one implication of that is we have opportunity to think together, to have a conversation. Intellectuals, all of us, applying our minds from different traditions. And so I think there is need for that sort of engagement, although I don't know that needs to reflect a hierarchy per se.
I suspect Aaron Wren completely disagrees.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say, I think it's unpopular to say it, it's unpopular to think it, you know, but I think it is true that every society does have a sort of a ruling class. And it is true, and it, historically in America, the different denominations did reflect different kind of class levels. So the kind of, you know, working class, agricultural class was likely to be Baptist. The educated kind of teaching classes were likely to be Presbyterian, and the squirearchy and those in government leadership were likely to be Episcopalian. And I think there's echoes of that even now, where it is the case if you're going to be politically engaged, and you're not going to become Roman Catholic, you are likely to become Anglican, and that. So the Anglicans are still occupying that kind of top position on the social ladder for Protestants.
And this goes back to, again, I've talked about the Chuck Colson born again, and I'm paraphrasing this moment in the book. So if you look at it, you won't find it exactly, but, you know, Chuck Colson is in a world of trouble. Richard Nixon's, you know, who's going to win the election by broad strokes anyway, and his paranoia had the whole Watergate burglary, and Chuck Colson has been, you know, Johnny on the spot, the man behind Nixon and doing all of this, and Nixon's going to leave him hung out to dry, and Colson's realizing he's going to go to jail, and there's a group of Christians in Washington, D.C., that sort of take him in. And at one point, he sort of goes home to his wife and says, "Honey, I'm a Christian." And she kind of looks at him and is like, "I thought we were Episcopalian." And it's just in that Chuck Colson moment, you see this turn in America. I've been listening to the JFK, The Rest is History series. And part of what's interesting is, of course, JFK is the early 60s. The counterculture is going to deeply change the country. They're talking about the Bay of Pigs invasion, and they're talking about, you know, right away, JFK knew it was a bad idea, and when the Bay of Pigs invasion starts to go wrong, people are like pressuring him to, you know, bring in bombers and, you know, back it up, and JFK's like, "This is a dumb idea to begin with." Well, and then Tom Holland asks him, "Well, then why did they go along with it?" Because same with Vietnam and all of these things, we felt we needed to look strong. And there's the big turning point in many ways. This again, I read this for the day one thinking about the ARC conference. And to me, this turn is right here. Then something happens between the 1950s and 1970s. The High Wasps collectively decide to abandon the old rightist aristocratic model and to turn into a more progressive model. They keep doing it. They keep doing all the same things, sending their kids to Harvard, passing along multi-generational wealth and all, but started believing there was no difference from the rest of society and downplaying the habits and behaviors that led to their success. This is the Machiavelli Pareto model we've discussed. The aristocracy, which once ruled through confidence, competence, and force, being strong, over time degenerates, that's of course Thornburg's value judgment, into an oligarchy of manipulation, cunning, and deceit. And really it's a turn towards the therapeutic. Now, we're not going to be the king in charge, we're going to be the therapist facilitating. Pareto called this aristocracy lions versus the aristocracy of foxes. Lions are proud, forceful aristocrats who explicitly own their position as leaders. Foxes, however, are humble servants who will deny, forever deny, that they're in charge. While lions want to run the world, foxes want to save the world. Because our new elites are foxes, not lions, they no longer feel comfortable celebrating productive habits for the rest of society. And I know some of you out there are saying, "Vanderclay, you're such a frickin' fox." And Rightly so, in many respects. Rightly so. You should be a lion. There's a reason the lions sort of started acting like foxes. Every now and then, they'll come out as a lion. But in terms of the public display, they're foxes. Now, of course, the Roman cat, you know, part of the complaint, all of this warfare about, you know, white evangelicals, the complaint is that they're lions. And what they ought to be are therapists. Now, don't forget, it's at the same point that evangelicals started saying things like Christianity isn't a religion, it's a relationship. The old elites used to have a sense of common responsibility and noblesse oblige. Not just give back, but expect the masses to act in a way that they would let them rise up as well. Old elites knew that on average they had more productive habits than the masses. Marital fidelity, two-parent household, steady employment. And so this was thus their job, to provide the masses an example to aspire to. But our new elites are less likely to admit they're more productive. If anything, they deny it. While the humility seems generous on the surface, it's nicer to imply that elites are successful successful solely because of the privilege and not because they're more productive. Now, Unheard just put out a video on the battle for San Francisco, and it's probably, like with the Ayaan Hirsi Ali, there'll be a version of this that comes out to YouTube in a few days. And it's all about this, because the San Francisco aristocracy want to be foxes. They want to be therapists. They want to, you know, we're not going to tell any of these homeless people what to do. We're just going to, well, we're going to provide them with crack pipes and needles. So when they OD, they'll do so safely. And then if they do OD, we'll have the right drugs on site so we can bring them back to life to have them OD again. It kind of reminds me of that Tom Cruise movie where he keeps dying and dying and dying and they keep bringing him back. It was so interesting because Steve Smith is the only one participating in this live stream. And I'm pretty sure this is our Steve Smith here in the corner that quite regularly leaves comments, because these are things that he's interested in.
And I think we do need to think seriously about, you know, if there's going to be some kind of, you know, Christian renewal in America, which is sort of feels like a pipe dream, but obviously is that to which we should be working toward.
Not a lot of confidence there. And that's in contrast to Richard Roland. I still have to find that clip. So any of you in Grim Grizz's group that want to find this clip of Richard Roland in one of the Universal History basically saying, I think it was could have been in Nationalism, but I might not remember right, we're basically saying, yeah, in 300 years, North America will all be Orthodox. Well, he's roaring.
Then we do need to have denominations that are thinking in terms of actually forming people for positions of social and political leadership. And I think we have so many generations of kind of de facto, sorry, my phone is making noise here. Let me silence that. Anyway, so many generations of pietism that we're competing against, but.
You know, That's right. And it's helpful to remember, too, that fundamentalists avoided dirty politics for many, many years. And it wasn't until the 1980s that sort of the moral majority brought fundamentalists in. And the reward that fundamentalists get for coming into politics is to be the whipping dogs for other evangelicals who complain about them. Well, the Catholics just sneak on by right onto the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And don't forget, the current president is also a Roman Catholic. I'll let y'all Catholics decide about your own.
I'm very influenced by E. Digby Baltzel, the sociologist, who coined the term WASP, basically. He wrote a great book called Puritan Boston and Quaker Philadelphia that is extremely good. And one of the things he points out is that the Protestant culture of Boston and the Puritans actually was hierarchical and did have these status entities within them. And one reason is that their sense of election applied to much more than just salvation. It applied to your role in society and other things, whereas the Quakers were much more leveling, of course. And yeah, Baltzel thinks that the Quaker values won out in America over the Puritan ones to the country's detriment in terms of its leadership culture. And we certainly see this a bit in kind of the evangelical world. I don't want to spend all my time on this.
Now, this is, again, this is a major point that Aaron makes, and it comes through in his, even though it's conservative, comes through in his critique of evangelicalism with respect to masculine, feminine issues. And, you know, I think it's, I think it's really helpful to put this up. Now, again, a lot of people who listen to me a lot are going to say, well, Vanderclay, you are such a fox. And, yeah, in many ways I am. And, but I think it's really helpful to look at this, because this is also, this also becomes a part of the American empire. The United States is the strangest kind of empire. So when Donald Trump, who is not Roman Catholic, Donald Trump, who's mainline-ish, you know, Norman Vincent Peale, the power of positive thinking, Donald Trump comes into, you know, when he's campaigning, he's like, yeah, you know, that Iraq war, we should have kept those oil fields. So everyone's like, that's not the kind of empire America decided to be in the 20th century. In the 19th century, yeah, we kept Texas. Yeah, we kept California. Yeah, we kept Arizona. Yeah, we kept New Mexico, Colorado. We kept the, you know, we kept all that stuff. And now we're sort of apologizing for it, but we're not giving it back. And you see this movement to the therapeutic, where now America is going to be a generous empire. And we had that after the Second World War. And that worked tremendously in terms of Japan and Germany. In a sense, you know, the what happened in Germany in terms of Versailles, it was like, no, you don't. Now, I don't know if this was, you don't just sort of dominate Germany. You rehabilitate Germany. You rehabilitate Japan so that they grow back up into powerful allies, and then you're stronger than before. So, you know, be careful, you lions or people out there that would be lions, that this American posture isn't foolish, especially living in a world of pervasive pluralism. So definitely listen to the whole thing. The whole thing is a great conversation. And he talks about theology. But Aaron's not going to let this issue go, because this is his issue.
Complete understanding of the history, not just the potted version the Catholics might like to tell of some of this. Another theological point that you say is appealing is Catholic social teaching. What role does that play?
Yeah, well, this is, again, you know, for me, coming a lot out of the DC orbit, and Christians, you know, Christians who are concerned with defending sanctity of life issues, defending traditional marriage,
Now, again, as many people, you hear this far more, many people will point out that when in 1973, this was not a white evangelical issue, abortion wasn't. There you could find conservative Baptist churches that celebrated it for their own various reasons. It's the Catholics that really hammered down on abortion.
You know, it's not just a DC bubble thing anymore, right? As the kind of the tide of progressivism has become much more aggressive, people in every part of the country are facing these questions of how do we raise our kids to actually take these traditional moral commitments seriously. And the evangelical approach has been to just sort of point to a few biblical proof texts, but more and more, that works as long as one is inhabiting a plausibility structure, right, within which, well, you know, of course marriage is between a man and woman. Oh, and by the way, here's a couple Bible verses, right? But once it's no longer, well, of course marriage is between a man and woman, once there's a kind of a comprehensive attack on the plausibility of that, then just appealing to isolated scriptures doesn't necessarily persuade the young people, and people actually want to understand how do these moral commitments fit together into a coherent whole that makes sense of that is a, you know, compelling account of human nature. And that's where, again, this is the reformers themselves were all over these issues. The reformers themselves had a strong doctrine of natural law. They understood that they weren't just interested in, you know, preaching justification by faith, but in talking about what does the Christian life look like, and giving a comprehensive social teaching for the reform of society, and showing how biblical morality was not just a list of do's and don'ts, but was an account of human nature. All that you can see in original reformers, but not today. In the last century, it's really only Roman, or to a large extent, it's only been Roman Catholics who've been giving that kind of holistic moral witness that connects scripture and nature. And so I think that is, a lot of people are drawn to it because they just, again, they assume the Roman Catholics are the only ones they hear talking about it, so they must be the only ones who have these answers.
Catholic social teaching in particular is one I find a little strange. I don't claim to be an expert on it, but I was doing a little reading, and even if you look at something as basic as like the Wikipedia page in Encyclopedia, basically they say it only dates to the late 19th century. This is not some timeless theology. It's something that's very new. And I say, what was going on in the Protestant world at the time this was happening? I would argue better answers, and actually the ones that were adopted. It was the progressive movement. It was the social gospel. It was the settlement house movement. It was muscular Christianity. Protestants were very involved in taming the Industrial Revolution and many of the concerns that may have driven some of this development of Catholic social teaching. But it seems to me that all the things Protestant did are either treated as just generically American by the Catholic conservatives. They have basically their hermeneutic of American history is to treat everything Protestants did as America and everything the Catholics did as Catholic. And naturally that makes Catholics look pretty good. But then...
Except that, of course, to a degree, they're right, because America was deeply Protestant. These were the Protestant answers. And, you know, part of what you have to look at, too, is a lot of this, you know, implicit in a lot of what we've done over the last 5-6 years is look at the world downstream from England, which had all of these reform movements. How did it go in Catholic, you know, in Spanish colonies? How did it go in French colonies? And how did it go in the English colonies, and especially in the United States and Canada, in Australia? And, you know, Aaron has a very strong point here that, in a lot of ways, the Roman Catholics have been playing catch-up, and that a lot of that catch-up had to come in the 19th century.
You know, the evangelicals themselves basically reject that entire list that I just mentioned, when I think there's actually maybe some bad things in the social gospel, probably some good things in there. And in fact, it was actually the Protestant thinkers who ultimately tamed industrialization and urbanization and all of these things are causing so many problems and made them work for American society. But we don't even seem to talk about that. And that was not that long ago.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what you get at there is, you know, Catholic social teaching doesn't fit neatly into our partisan boxes, right? It scratches some progressive itches and scratches some conservative itches. And of course, there is no, I mean, you can't get two Catholics necessarily agree on what exactly Catholic social teaching is. But it is this body of moral teaching that is trying to grapple with the challenges of the modern world in a way that doesn't just fit into a partisan box. And I think that's what makes it, again, you know, compelling to many evangelicals who are, recognize that there is a larger set of issues than just the ones, you know, on the Republican side of the ballot. But as you say, Protestants do have a heritage of wrestling through those things and in ways that have deeply shaped the American social order. And we just, we just totally forget that there was a specifically Protestant faith contribution to those things.
Right. Protestantism had a better answer to modernity than Catholicism did. Arguably, Catholicism has never fully reconciled itself to modernity. Its big attempt was Vatican II, which we'll see where that project ultimately ends up leaving them. And if you look at the people who are attracted into Catholicism today, a lot of them seem to be people who want to escape modernity. They want to go back to the Latin Mass. They want to go back to some Melkite parish. They're looking to essentially embrace the pre-modern, which I think there's a lot of...
And of course, I mean, the Orthodox are doing the same.
...good in that, and I share some of those impulses, but they're not going to Catholicism because Catholicism has a better answer for 21st century America. Protestantism actually, for a very long time, delivered better answers. And it wasn't that long ago that the mainline denominations essentially abandoned classic theology. But, you know, in a faithful sense, they basically built modernity in many ways.
Comments for this are going to be spicy. They really are. But Aaron's, you know, and this is sort of where I am always feel like a tweener in here, because we are dealing with what's going on. And, you know, and so someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali comes in and says, you know, we need more lions. We need civilizational confidence. We need civilizational Christianity. And of course, Protestants delivered on civilizational Christianity. Now, they had to do it without a hierarchy, and they had to do it sort of implicitly. And in that sense, what happened was that the Protestants wouldn't meet within their own siloed church structures. They would use the open public square to meet as Christians. They didn't emphasize it because nearly everyone was. And so you get a Catholic and a Jew come in. Okay, that's fine. Of course, what's happening with Islam now, especially given the fact that, well, they haven't sort of gone through the agreements built into the Enlightenment that all the Protestants, and to a certain degree, a lot of the Catholics have sort of agreed to it. Here's the playing field. These are the things we'll agree with. This is how we're going to move forward. And many Jews did too. I mean, some of my most interesting conversations with Jacob have been about what happened to Jews in the 19th and 20th century, as they also come into modernity, as they deeply secularized. So this has been going on a while.
It's an interesting time to have the conversation across the Catholic-Protestant intersection, because in some respects, there's healthy ecumenism happening. We're listening to one another. We're learning from one another. But then there is this resurgent conservatism, which looks back in a polemical fashion that's not always healthy. If I go up here to St. Mary of the Lake, which is the largest Roman Catholic seminary in the nation, in Mundelein, you will see students walking around with full cassocks, very concerned about Latin Mass. And to your point, part of that is appealing and good. Let's appropriate our tradition. But it also creates a serrated edge that makes healthy dialogue difficult.
Yes,
and this has been part of what's been really interesting in our little corner, because we have plenty of serrated edge orthos and Catholics here, but we're still talking. And you know, many have noted that there's a deep ecumenism that is happening here in the corner. I was sitting with Chad on the bus at Chino, and Chad's like, wouldn't it be great if everyone here in the bus were in the same church? I'm like, we can't even have communion together, everyone here in this bus. I mean, we had that in Thunder Bay, and I remember when Scott was like, we're going to do communion, and I thought, we're going to try to do communion with this group? It's, you know, the Orthodox aren't going to have communion for one reason. The Catholics aren't going to have communion. The Protestants, well, a lot of these Protestants will have communion with anyone. And, you know, and I was worried. I didn't want people to feel excluded, so foxy me. And so it's a fascinating moment, but I think this ecumenical moment again is partly because many of these issues, well, arose at the same time. And so some, in some ways, they're also receding at the same time. And so now's an opportunity for us to talk about the issues involved.
I think Protestantism would be at its best if it kept a foot in the past and a foot in the future, which I think is something that Catholicism has not done as well. It does seem to be much more retro-trad, or we're going to go back and homestead. Again, there's a lot of Protestants who are into homesteading and things of that nature either, but it seems like there's an idea to reject the modern, and I would argue that Protestantism had a better answer to the modern than Catholicism did. All that was the theology.
I want to bring in these two. Someone, one of you sent me a video from them, and I should contact them, because these two are fascinating and they're making some very interesting videos. And so what's happening now with both incredible pluralism, having lived together for a time, the breakdown of sort of the old ways of working, the breakdown of the lines between, that it is kind of a crazy free-for-all out there. And just looking at these two make it look that way.
Maybe even were raised in secular households, but then are like, I'm going to raise my kid Jewish or Muslim or Christian, and we're going to go to church. But at the same time, they don't really believe it. Like my parents, for example, they had this moment where they decided to become born again Buddhists. And they were like, okay, we're going to send you to Dharma school. And they meant to do it, but then they never really followed through with it because they actually didn't really believe, I think. Like they weren't really that into it. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, not exactly. I think a lot of these people really do believe it.
Okay.
But for their parents' generation, for the Gen X religious generation, religion was primarily about the belief. The belief guided all other actions tied to the religion.
Modern propositionalism.
For these individuals, it's 50% belief, 50% structure and aesthetics. So the classic example of somebody like this is the person who maybe grew up in a conservative Protestant household and then becomes like a tradcath because they think like Catholicism is a more conservative, more structured iteration. They're often converting to the more structured iteration of religions.
Yeah.
So they're much more likely to become Orthodox Christians. So by that, what I mean, I don't mean general Orthodox. I'm talking like Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, et cetera, or tradcaths or traditional Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
Those are the three groups where I see this represented in the most. I haven't seen that many Protestants who stay Protestants doing this. And I think the reason is because the Protestant faith has less ritual and structure to it. And the point that I'm making here is that for many of these individuals, the ritual and structure is 50% of the point. Whereas for the previous generation, it was God was 100% of the point and everything else was downstream from that.
That makes sense.
And of course, they wouldn't say that it's 50% of the point. But what I mean when I say this is when I look at the fervency with which they adhere to the ritual and in which they signal the ritual, they seem, if I'm going to word it in a way, almost they remind me more of goths from my childhood than religious kids from my childhood.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
That's a super, super observation.
You know, where the religious people didn't need to constantly be signaling that they were religious all the time. They were constantly trying to convert me, whereas the goths needed to constantly be signaling how gothy they were.
Yeah, but they weren't necessarily, they weren't trying to convert you. And also they were kind of in it to be, just to not be a normie, right? Like, I feel like half the people who are goths or whatever new subculture there is of the day, they're in it to just not be like mainstream society.
And of course, this is where sort of being LGBTQ is a religion, because, boy, if you're just white dude or especially a white girl who isn't astoundingly beautiful, or if you're a white dude and you're not astoundingly a jock, well, how on earth do you climb the status hierarchy, get attention, be the focus of anything? Change your gender. That's how you do it.
Society. And that is
what every one of these... Yeah.
Continue. Now, I want to be careful to say they're not necessarily doing that intentionally, thinking, ooh, I'm status hierarchies and this sort of, no, it's what you do and you just inch into it and you try it. Well, I got attention. And so there you go. And you get more attention.
Well, that's what I see with a lot of new converts or people who are going more hardline from a softer religion.
Yeah. And so these religious institutions are doing well. And I want to point out that I don't mean this disparagingly at all. I actually think that all of the rituals and framing and weird dress codes and everything like that, weird, where weird is defined from differentiating from mainstream society. Which
so
is
more hard religious, more hard religious.
Yeah, I think it's all useful in maintaining their culture and passing their culture down intergenerationally. I think that these young people...
A little early for that, because these are the kids who are doing it. And this is the question I had about the Ortho Bros. And 20 years from now, will be... This is where you sort of get into, again, Hans-Georg Müller's first there was sincerity, which is fulfilling your traditional role. Your identity is received, not achieved. And then there's authenticity, where your identity is achieved. I'm trying to find myself deep inside my secret, sacred self. And then once I think I have it, or actually the process of sort of trying this and trying that, of coloring my hair, or maybe dating someone of the same sex, or maybe kissing them, or something like this, is where I'm going to try. And if I do it and it feels authentic to me, then I'll do it a little more and I'll do it a little more. And so that's sort of the way that I discover my secret, sacred self. And then, of course, on top of this, we've got the profelicity level, where I don't actually have to do anything. I just have to sort of change my identity on... I was going to say Facebook, but that's when grandma changes her identity. I have to change my identity on Instagram or TikTok, and then it will be something new.
Recognize something about religion that their parents had forgotten because their parents didn't have as strong an enemy constantly battering at their doors. And so they had forgotten all of the purposes of all of the defensive structures and fortifications that had been built up over the year. They're like, oh yeah, that pile of old guns, we don't need those anymore. That pile, you know, this old wall. Well, I mean, I understand it was a castle wall, but nobody ever attacks this castle anymore. So let's tear it down to put a road there. You know, and now this younger generation is like, build it all back up, you know, restore the guns, everything like that, right? So
anyway, these two are a hoot. They are fun to listen to. But I want to get back to the other video, because there's a theological point there that is absolutely important with respect to this question of sacramentalism.
I want to get to some of the other ones in your book. Moving on to theology, one of the theological points you hit was sacramentalism. What role does Catholic sacramentology play in conversion?
Yeah, I think that chapter is concerned with maybe tangible grace, and that is experiencing worship in a way that is textured, that's rooted in history, that pays attention to aesthetics. And there is, of course, a very important tradition in the Magisterial Reformers coming from Scripture that has the sacraments as in the foreground, as the visible words. So we want to lean into that. But when we come together in community, what does it look like? And more and more, there is a longing to encounter habits of life that are embodied, that are holistic. And here again, this is where we evangelicals, I think, sometimes fall short. By emphasizing propositions, we can maintain a cerebral faith that doesn't properly attend to the incarnational embodied dimensions of Christian life.
When I first read Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age, got a huge amount of press, even in the evangelical world. I knew within 50 pages he was a Catholic. And after reading that book, I said, this is the most devastating critique of Protestantism I have ever read. And it wasn't even the main point of his book. But one of his things that really struck me was this idea of Protestantism as an excarnated faith, that it neglects the physical dimensions of our existence. It does seem that in contemporary evangelicalism, basically our faith is two things. It's a set of statements, truth claims, to which we give essentially mental assent, And it's a set of inward dispositions of the heart that animate our actions. But there doesn't seem to be the physical aspects of the faith that exist more in Catholicism, which does seem to have a more incarnational aspect. Is this something that Protestantism got wrong, or are we just in a bad place today?
I know y'all are answering that right now.
And it seems to me that it's actually quite ironic if you think back to the Reformation itself, where, if anything, the shoe was on the other foot. I mean, even on the in the narrow point of sacramental theology, I like to point out that the debate in the main debate in the Reformation was not over whether the body of Christ was present in the Eucharist, but whether bread was present in the Eucharist, right? The Catholic view, the transubstantiation said, the bread ceases to be bread, the wine ceases to be wine. There's a discarnation right there, in that the physical created element.
Now, I know some of you are already debating him. Just hear him out. You can debate him in the comment section. I'm sure you can find his email on the internet and send Brett Sockold after him.
Elements cannot actually mediate grace as themselves. They have to be turned into something else. Whereas Protestants sought to affirm, no, the bread, precisely by remaining bread, is what mediates the presence of Christ, right? And this extended more broadly, I think, into the theology of Christian life, where the reformers were reacting against a kind of anti-body mindset within a lot of medieval Catholicism that valorized virginity, right? Marriage was very much a second-rate form of Christian life. And if you actually wanted to be holy, you sought to deny the body and deny the bodily desires. So I think, if anything, Protestantism was more sacramental, more incarnational, in the sense that people use those terms now, at the time of the Reformation. And the narrative of how we got from there to here is a long and complicated narrative, but I don't think the wrong turns, I don't think, were made on day one.
In many ways, again, we have a crisis of success that, if you look at a lot of Protestants, well, what is doing good? Well, it's helping the poor. It's showing mercy. It's doing all of these things. There's the doing good. Now, of course, Catholic and Orthodox are not going to disagree with that. But those things come first, and the rituals come second. And it's mercy, not sacrifice. And, well, how does that play into the Jewish context? Because that's what, when I make the point about when I read the book of Leviticus or the book of Exodus with respect to substitution. Oh no! It's just that do-gooding. And then, of course, you have the secular Jews that have embodied that pretty completely. Oh, that they might still go to synagogue and do some of these things, but it's actually saving the world. And again, I think of Brett Weinstein and his recent Dave Rubin conversation. So I've introduced a new set of characters to the corner. These two, based camp with Simone and Malcolm Collins, and yeah, their videos are a wild ride. They really are, and I haven't listened to that much of them, but it's interesting stuff, and I've already got ideas for the thumbnail for this video, so it's going to be spicy. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.